The right podcast. The right podcast.
Well, am I pure evil? Am I the face of terror sitting here in front of you? Or am I able to talk to you man to man?
Get prosecutors to agree. Atkinson faces one count of first degree murder for now, and he's being held on $1 million bond.
Directly behind Eric Rudolph in the courtroom today, his sentencing hearing was emotionally wrenching. Survivors of his clinic.
Hello, and welcome to the Right Podcast. In this video, we're going to be talking about Jim Atkinson, and there's previous work done by the podcast on Jim Atkinson. We're going to wrap it all into one here, keep it as concise as we can, but also have it apply to events that have happened since the shooting and events that are happening today. So who was Jim Atkinson? Well, Jim Atkinson was a man that was radicalized by right-wing media. He shot two people, injured many more. He shot them specifically because he thought that they were liberals. He believed that the Knoxville Unitarian Universalist Church was a place where liberals gathered. And through a number of grievances that were spurred on by right-wing rhetoric, right-wing hate speech, right-wing media, he decided to take it upon himself to act. And as we'll see, if you believe the things that he was listening to, there is a kernel of understanding as to someone with a sick mind who listens to this type of rhetoric that existed then and has only accelerated and become more radical in today's world. Might decide to act upon it. Jim Atkinson is really the embodiment of the modern right-wing resentment, but also media-driven radicalization as well as violence. While this was in 2008, this was really a boiling point when we still had talk radio happening, the internet was in full swing. Fox News had launched and was also in full swing. And we had the election of Barack Obama. So all these things were coming together. And while right-wing resentment, hate speech, media to instigate and inflame people's hatred, well, all that's existed for many years, and you could argue exists throughout the political spectrum, this is a unique case. Because it really is a watershed moment for the country. And unfortunately, as we'll see, there has not been any type of cohesive, coherent reaction to it. And if anything, things have just gotten worse since the shooting. Conducting a search for images just on Google Images, you can see just how little this case has been discussed nationally since it happened. And I think one of the key indicators to that is this podcast, which only has a few episodes out and is relatively new and admittedly a part-time venture. This podcast was one of the top results when you look for Jim Atkinson and the Unitarian Universalist Church shooting. All the other ones here date back to around the time of the event, with a few images here or there for the 10-year anniversary that occurred. But even with these images, generally, there's some national media, but the bulk of it is local media. One of the most compelling components to this case is how outward and undeniable right-wing media and hate speech were in motivating Jim Atkinson. And it's important because, again, in these situations, what we often see are scenarios in which individuals are portrayed, again, as lone wolves, mental illness is discussed, there's attempted equivalency. However, you can't do that with this case. And it can be frustrating when looking at other cases when the very clear and the self-evident line between right-wing media radicalization and hate speech to whatever act of violence the individual perpetrated is very clear. However, it gets washed and equivalencies occur and vagueness happens. You can't do that with Jim Acheson. And this was all over even national news during the time. But even today, you can still go online and find Jim Acheson's manifesto. And we'll look at it later in this video. But within that manifesto, he clearly spells out that this was political, that this was a hate crime. And the bullet points essentially that he provides us could be copy and pasted from any Fox News show, any AM radio show, or any number of today in the modern world right-wing influencers on Twitter or social media, etc. And you know, this isn't an opinion. As a matter of fact, Matthew Chamberlain, who was a convict who spent time in jail with Acheson, even said that Acheson's motivations were purely ideological, and Acheson had talked to him about it. But don't take my word for it or that of a convict. Let's listen to some audio from an individual that was at the church during the shooting after Jim Acheson's trial.
And at that, the minute I got my hands on the gun, the other guys hit him and we were down on the floor in a second and a half. In the mind, in a troubled and bitter and evil mind, hate speech can lead to violent action. And I think people who are decent citizens need to tell the sponsors who profit from hate speech that we need to cut down on the hate speech that's broadcast.
And just to hammer that point home, there's a video from Knoxville News Sentinel. Again, a lot of this coverage is local coverage for this case. And in this video is the same audio that we just listened to. Even here a year ago in the comment section, we can see someone saying that he was a hero. So again, don't take my word for it. You don't need to believe the audio of a person that was actually there when this happened. Just look in the comment section and you can see this is still something that's still very relevant in today's world. And we'll come back to this graphic later after we look at the manifesto. But again, you don't need to take my word for it or that of someone commenting on YouTube or that of a survivor. Essentially, the things that had radicalized Acheson, which at the time might have been considered a bit fringe, might not have shown up on Fox News until, 8 o'clock at night, might have been relegated to AM radio or the comment sections on certain websites. Those sentiments have essentially been mainstreamed since 2008. And we'll reiterate this at the end, but one of the key takeaways from looking at this murder after reading Jim Acheson's manifesto and looking at all of the social events that kind of ran parallel in his life along his track of radicalization, what we'll see is that Jim Acheson got much of what he wanted. He was able to murder people that he thought were liberal. He called for other people to do the same as him, which has happened, unfortunately. And many of the things that he calls out in his manifesto are just commonplace today in 2021, 2022, to the point where they're not radical at all. As a matter of fact, they're just mainstream white right-wing ideas. But okay, those are some high-level, big picture things. Let's kind of scope down and get a bit more granular about who this person was, where they came from. So Jim Acheson was born in 1950 in Tennessee. He was adopted as a newborn by Jim and Carolyn Acheson. So he himself was adopted. This was apparently arranged by a doctor. And early in Atkinson's life, there's not a lot of details, but it seems as if things were just normal. He was a Boy Scout. That was an institution that he loved throughout his life. And in his manifesto, he called out, claiming liberals were destroying it. He graduated from high school in Harriman, Tennessee. It's a small city, under 7,000 people. It's about an hour outside of Knoxville. You can look on this map here, Chattanooga to the south. Harriman appears to have some charm about it. Seems like a nice area. Many historic Victorian houses, lots of parks, rivers, outdoor activities. A place that you would think, you know, any kid would enjoy growing up in. A Harriman resident, Orman Chip Dunn, said that he grew up with Atkinson. He said Atkinson was a normal kid. He liked the Boy Scouts. That seemed to be a big thing with them. Atkinson married shortly after graduating from Harriman High School. He was only 19 years old. According to a relative, D. Atkinson, Jim's first marriage was very short. D. said that it was a bad marriage and that Atkinson left Harriman around the age of 20. We'll see that Atkinson is married multiple times and divorced multiple times. And this type of life disruption spills over and is connected to his issues with gainful employment as well. Atkinson's story is interesting because he's of the boomer generation. And there's a lot of baggage that comes along with that, which has accumulated or manifested in some outburst of right-wing violence and extremism that we see today. Atkinson, recall, was only 20 years old after his first failed marriage. And he essentially roamed around the United States in his early 20s. This would be the early 1970s. And there was a lot happening in the United States during this time. The US had recently gone through the civil rights movement. There was the hippie movement of peace and love. Vietnam had ended or was ending, and it was seen as kind of a lost cause, a disgrace. President Nixon was stepping down from the presidency, facing impeachment. And Nixon's platform, his whole idea of new federalism, and his personality was very much steeped in resentment. And Nixon had resentment towards Democrats in general, but specifically John F. Kennedy. It was only a decade or so earlier that the first televised presidential debate pitted Nixon against the more charismatic and dashing Kennedy. And while some might say Nixon was better prepared and seemed more informed on the issues, the fact that he was visibly sweating, that he was giving off cues that are just not seen as being confident. Again, it was one of the first televised debates too, that that Kennedy had won this debate. And so there was a lot of resentment with Nixon, including in an infamous line.
Just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Along with this time in history with these protests and Richard Nixon, there was just a overall kind of incubation for white male resentment. The world was changing. There had been second wave feminism that started in the 60s and was gaining traction in the 1970s with legal successes. Roe v. Wade, the landmark case allowing women the right to choose, occurred in 1973. Barnes v. Tran, often cited as the first sexual harassment case, occurred in 1974, along with the women's movement came new Black empowerment movements, as well as gay activism, LGBTQ movements, and in general, an uprising of what had formerly been silenced minority populations of people in activism and protest. And so it was in this culture, in this broader piece of American history, which obviously shaped events to come, not only in Atkinson's personal life, but broader politically as well as in right-wing violence. It was in this incubation period that Atkinson was really finding himself, he being a young man and wandering the country. Atkinson worked his way through Tennessee. He later ended up in Florida. And ultimately in 1974, so a few years after graduating high school and having his first divorce, Atkinson joined the Army. The Vietnam War had ended, of course, so there wasn't that call to action. But we have to remember that the Cold War was still very real. And while 1974 was a few years before Ronald Reagan, kind of there with Thatcher, the Reagan presidency would bring about a surge in anti-communist rhetoric, in patriotism and nationalism, which was also fueled by Hollywood tropes. And the Hollywood tropes often pitting the Soviet Union against the United States in this Cold War included things like individualism versus the government. Atkinson served as a helicopter repairman from the 101st Airborne Division at Fort Campbell until 1977, and then he entered the reserves. When he left the military in 1980, that the structure that it provided him also had left. And this era, again, of Ronald Reagan and inflammatory rhetoric is what Jim Atkinson was kind of being released into the world with.
Calumet, Colorado, population 8,200. Before the sun sets, foreign soldiers will march victorious through the streets. Eight high school students will take to the mountains, fight for freedom, and become a symbol to unite America.
Not bad for a bunch of kids.
Wolverines!
Red Dawn, rated PG-13. Starts Friday, August 10th. Check newspapers for a selected theater near you.
Adjacent to Atkinson, as well as broader cultural shifts in the United States, adjacent to these things were also the budding right-wing radio personalities and commentators. And Rush Limbaugh was one of the pioneers in this field starting in the 1970s. Initially, he started out in the morning commute crew for a small radio station in Pennsylvania. And like Atkinson, Limbaugh faced a series of early failures. Limbaugh bounced from station to station throughout the 1970s, even considering changing career paths at one point. But nearly a decade later, in 1988, kind of on the coattails of this Reagan rhetoric that we talked about earlier, Limbaugh began a new show on WABC in New York. He debuted just after the Democratic National Convention and weeks before the Republican National Convention. Another important figure in Atkinson's story, as well as kind of a generation story arc of right-wing extremism, was Michael Savage. So Michael Savage would one day become one of the most listened to right-wing radio hosts in the nation. Savage, like so many white men of the era, suffered from a feeling of resentment. For Savage, it had apparently started with those who were receiving welfare. Apparently, Savage felt deep resentment over the fact that his then supervisor delivered a check to a family receiving state aid for new furniture. And Savage felt that the people were being treated better than he was. This, along with the rejection of a manuscript titled Immigrants and Epidemics, seems to have set Savage on a right-wing trajectory. While talk radio had existed prior to this time, of course, it was in this period that modern right-wing media formula was being developed. The moral majority, politicizing the Christian right, became a major force in right-wing politics during the 1970s and 1980s. And you know, along with this new evangelical Christianity came along those Nixon-era resentments. Lee Atwater was Ronald Reagan's campaign manager, and he had an infamous recorded interview in which he stated that in 1954, he started out saying N-word, N-word, N-word. By 1968, you can't say N-word. That hurts you, it backfires. So you say stuff like forced busing and states' rights and all that stuff, and you're getting so abstract. Now you're talking about cutting taxes, and all these things you're talking about are totally economic things. And a byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than whites. We want to cut this is much more abstract even than the busing thing, and a hell of a lot more abstract than the N-word and the N-word. And of course, in this recording, he did not say the N-word. He actually said the N-word. And Reagan brought about this more abstract racism as well. And he brought it into the White House and into mainstream American culture. He fabricated stories about Chicago welfare queen living high on the hog and strapping young bucks buying T-bone steaks with food stamps. And you know, this is the type of resentment that you still see today with this generation, and unfortunately, even younger generations of people that are influenced by right-wing propaganda and right-wing rhetoric. During this era, there's not a whole lot of documentation on what Atkinson was doing, aside from bouncing from job to job and engaging in numerous failed marriages. Atkinson married yet again in 1990 to Lisa Alexander. Mutual friends said that Atkinson was prone to long periods of depression and moodiness. Smallwood, a lifelong acquaintance, said of Atkinson, he always had this attitude that the government was trying to get him. He disliked blacks, gays, anyone who was a different color or just different from him. Atkinson was a loner. He was an isolated individual, and he began to drink heavily. During one night of particularly heavy drinking, Atkinson lashed out in anger at his new wife, Lisa. While this is the only documented act of threatening violence, there very well could have been other previous acts of escalation. According to the Anderson County Court records, Atkinson stated that he had an option. And the option included blowing his wife's brains out and then doing the same to himself. Lisa filed an order of protection against him on March 1st in the year 2000. 2 days later, Lisa had filed for divorce. Atkinson was later arrested for a DUI after the divorce. And this was no doubt a low point in his life in the early 1990s. It was during this time that AM radio filled a niche for a segment of the population who found a community among people that would call in on a daily basis, as well as the program host. This provided a familiar voice, sometimes a voice that seemed like it was a voice of reason on a daily basis. Personalities like Rush Limbaugh and Steve Savage rose to prominence during the Clinton administration. They spun conspiracies ranging from murder for hire plots involving the Clinton family to global conspiracy theories, mixing and combining elements of anti-Semitic tropes of Jewish global domination, satanic one world order, government predictions that were based in the New Testament, and Red Scare propaganda from the Cold War. But at the heart of these conspiracies was the belief that ordinary Christian Americans were under attack by liberals who had some type of radical agenda. It was in this group dynamic that loners and resentful, oftentimes white Christian men throughout the United States found like-minded people and a sense of belonging. These weren't blatant hate groups. They weren't the KKK. They weren't skinhead groups. But instead, they were somewhat socially acceptable echo chambers of resentment and conspiracies that were forming. It was during this time that there was the rise of the Patriot Movement and the rise of militias in the United States. There are some key events that happened, which we'll talk about separately because they're large and significant in their own right, but specifically thinking about Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City bombing, the largest act of domestic terrorism ever to occur in the United States, the largest act of terrorism on American soil, next only to September 11th. Eric Rudolph, who set off bombs at the Atlanta Olympics in protest over what he saw as socialism, a one world order government, and anti-abortion attitudes. There was the raid at Waco with the cult of David Koresh in which he was abusing underage girls and stockpiling weapons. And of course, the events of Ruby Ridge as well with Randy Weaver, who had provided illegal weapons to an FBI informant and had been organizing with right-wing white nationalist militias and hate groups in the area. So none of these things are individuals. None of these actions are siloed. And unfortunately, the way that these things are portrayed, it's again often shown as some type of lone wolf or mental disorder, and or even in the case of someone like Randy Weaver and less so with David Koresh, but still with certain segments of the population, government overreach. When really the narrative that's missing is that these are all pieces of the same ecosystem. And that ecosystem is that of right-wing extremism, whether that be in a large group like the Montana militiamen, whether that be with a small group of individuals like Timothy McVeigh and the folks in his circle, or whether that be in manifestations on AM talk radio with Michael Savage saying the things that he said, and cable news with people like Bill O'Reilly having the platform to inflame conspiracy theories regarding Barack Obama and his heritage and conflating narratives of potential connections to Islamic terrorism. And while Fox News is certainly not the most extreme outlet for right-wing organizing, it certainly is one of the most important in terms of reaching households. With the launch of Fox News, what we see is the beginning of mainstream acceptance for these conspiracies, for this hate speech that up to this point had been somewhat relegated to political speeches and coded language, or AM radio, or even early internet chat rooms or comment sections on certain websites. Fox News was the official stamp of approval and really the entrance of these extreme views into mainstream political zeitgeist. And so, let's list an example of what some of these people were saying. We've mentioned O'Reilly. We've mentioned Michael Savage. Let's include Sean Hannity as well. And I'm specifically calling these people out because they're significant to this movement of right-wing hate speech and escalation, but also because when police searched Jim Acheson's house after the shooting spree at Knoxville Unitarian Universalist Church, they found Liberalism is a Mental Disorder, which was a book written by Michael Savage, Let Freedom Ring, which was a book written by Sean Hannity, and The O'Reilly Factor, which was a book, of course, written by Bill O'Reilly. So these are people that were influencing Jim Acheson. Let's hear the type of things that they say.
Tell me if you can hear me. Otherwise, I'll turn off again, because I want to talk about the birds and how the birds are the higher animals and what we see going on in the cities are the lower animals. Do I have to say any more? And I see the animals in the city looting, beating up vendors in Washington Square Park in the name of pride. Did you see what happened in New York under this communist degenerate, de Blasio? Have you seen what the liberals have done to New York City? And try to imagine what the world will become unless the lowest forms of humanity are not stopped very, very soon. Have a nice day, because I'm enjoying mine.
Personal story segment tonight, President Obama and Islam. That is the subject of this evening's Talking Points memo. Many Americans, including this one, believe Barack Obama's emotional attachment to the Muslim world has hurt the USA. Barack Obama's father, who abandoned his family, was a Muslim who eventually turned atheist. Then his mother married another Muslim, moving young Barry to Indonesia. You know, don't abandon your children. Don't get pregnant at 14. Don't allow your neighborhoods to deteriorate into free fire zones. That's what the African-American community should have on their T-shirts.
Ask yourself why this monster in the White House, the most deceitful, hateful, and power-hungry man in American political history, ask yourself why, of all the Syrians he has brought in, 99.6% are Muslims and only 0.4% are Christians, while a genocide is being conducted against not Muslims but Christians in the Middle East, because he is transforming America into part of the caliphate.
I heard, so you don't like white America, so tell me an African-dominated nation where you would do better.
That's not true. I do like white America.
No, I just, you just said this is a one-sided nation. The whites dominate and they're racist and they make you feel bad. Is there a nation that is ruled by black people where you might do better? Why is it that the races were moving together until this communist appeared in the White House? And now all of a sudden, all we hear is about grievance, 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 grievance.
So while these shows might provide some type of disclaimer in the beginning, saying something along the lines of the opinions expressed are not those of whatever news station or network so that they don't get sued, at no point are there disclaimers saying that this is entertainment. At no point is there a discussion about, you know, this kind of being hyperbolic in nature. It wasn't presented as kind of like a even roast style, maybe, you know, dark comedy or something along those lines. But instead, as you heard, and there is much more, which is just as bad, if not worse, available. These paint a very dark and dire situation in the world, one that's tangible. There's a tangible enemy to this. There is a bad guy in these narratives. This tangible enemy had taken up the cause of the United States' former foe, apparently, the Soviet Union, because you know, the term communism is just tossed around so freely. And a new foe during this era, radical Islam. Show after show questioned the then newly elected Barack Obama's allegiance to the United States. Something that maybe if you weren't alive at that time or were young and didn't pay attention, something that can't be understated, the conflation of terrorism, Islam, and Democrats or Barack Obama. There are many conspiracies that were kind of woven around Barack Obama, such as Jeremiah Wright, a controversial but retired pastor at Trinity United Church, Christ in Chicago. More traditional kind of fodder, such as Barack Obama being the Antichrist and these kind of New Testament conspiracies of one world government scenarios and the United Nations, et cetera, as well as somewhat illogical narratives. But the point remained that there is an enemy on American soil, and the enemy was liberals. And taking this at face value, if you don't accept this as being entertainment, if you don't accept this as just being hyperbolic, if you don't accept this as kind of the whataboutism that we see more so today of, well, you know, yeah, you know, they might have said that this person is a terrorist and they shouldn't have, but, you know, well, you guys do it too. Removing all of that and just, let's just say that we believe these things. Well, taking at face value, I mean, what else is a Vietnam veteran going to do? You know, these right-wing media narratives were directly articulated in Atkinson's manifesto. So let's listen to the manifesto and compare it to some of the language that we've heard so far and you know, possibly some language that you've heard on your own as well. I'll provide a disclaimer that this content includes racist, homophobic, and violent language. So, of course, discretion is going to be advised. The introduction in the first paragraph essentially discusses his grievances about the inability to maintain employment and concerns about his age and not seeing a bright future. But when we get to the second paragraph, that's really where the extremism gets involved. So this is Atkinson's writing. "I've always wondered why I was put on Earth. For years, I thought I was put here to die as cannon fodder in Vietnam, but somehow cheated the devil out of it. Lately, I've been feeling helpless in our war on terrorism, but I realized I could engage the terrorist allies here in America, the best allies that they've got, the Democrats. The Democrats have done everything they can do to tie our hands in this war on terror. They're all a bunch of traitors. They want America to lose this war for reasons I cannot understand, and it makes me so mad." In a parallel train of thought, it saddens me to think back on all the bad things that liberalism has done to the country. Liberals have attacked every major institution that made America great, from the Boy Scouts to the military, from education to religion. The major news outlets have become propaganda arms of the Democratic Party. Liberals are evil. They embrace the tenets of Karl Marx. They are Marxist, socialist, communists. The Unitarian Universalist Church. Don't let the word church mislead you. This isn't a church, it's a cult. They don't believe in God. They worship the God of secularism. These sick people aren't liberals, they are ultra-liberals. This is a collection of sickos, weirdos, and homos. The church is a fountainhead, the veritable wellspring of anti-American organizations like MoveOn.org, Code Pink, and other un-American groups. Those people are absolute hypocrites. They embrace every pervert that comes down the pike. But if they find out that you're a conservative, they absolutely hate you. I know, I've experienced it. I can't for the life of me understand why those people would embrace Marxism like they do. I'd like someone to do an expose on this church. It's a den of un-American vipers. They call themselves progressive. How's a white woman having an N-word baby progressive? How is a man sticking his up another man's progress? It's an abomination. It takes a warped mind to hate America, and it makes me so angry. I can't live with it anymore. This was a hate crime. I hate the damn left-wing liberals. There's a vast left-wing conspiracy in this country, and these liberals are working together to attack every decent and honorable institution in the nation, trying to turn this country into a communist state. This was a political protest. I am protesting the liberal Supreme Court justices for giving the terrorists at Gitmo constitutional rights. I'm protesting major news outlets, ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, PBS, for being the propaganda wing of the Democratic Party. It's criminal what they're getting away with. They are traitors. They must be stopped. I am protesting the DNC running such a radical leftist candidate. Osama Hussein, Obama, yo mama. No experience, no brains, a joke. Dangerous to America. He looks like Curious George. This was a symbolic killing. Who I wanted to kill was every Democrat in the Senate and in the House. The 100 people in Bernard Goldberg's book. I'd like to kill everyone in the mainstream media. But I knew these people were inaccessible to me. I couldn't get the generals and high-ranking officers of this Marxist movement, so I went after the foot soldiers, the liberals that vote in these traitorous people. Someone had to get the ball rolling, I volunteered. I hope others do the same. It's the only way we can rid America of this cancerous pestilence. In conclusion, no one gets out of this world alive. I've chosen to skip the bad years of poverty. I know my life is going downhill fast from here. The future looks bleak. I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. I'm absolutely fed up. So I thought I would do something good for this country, kill Democrats until the cops kill me. If decent, patriotic Americans could vote three times in every election, we could stem this tide of liberalism that is destroying America. Liberals are a pest like termites, millions of them. Each little bite contributes to the downfall of this great nation. The only way we can rid ourselves of the evil is to kill them in the streets, kill them where they gather. I encourage other like-minded people to do what I have done. If life ain't worth living anymore, don't just kill yourself. Do something for the country. Go kill liberals. Tell the cop that killed me, I said, thanks, I needed that. I have no next of kin, no living relatives. If you would, take my sorry carcass to the body farm or donate it to science or just throw me in the Tennessee River. Sincerely, Jim David Atkinson. And so we don't read that to spread the message or to spread hate. And we don't read that for shock value or to inflict trauma on others. We read that because it's vital to understand Jim Atkinson and because many of those grievances today in the world are expressed openly and freely. They're discussed on cable news that reach thousands and thousands and thousands of people every night. They're expressed on social media platforms without any moderation taking action. These have become socially acceptable grievances. So what were these main points? Anxiety over poverty and lack of employment. Democrats are allies to terrorists, something that we see in here today. Democrats are socialists and communists, something that we see in here today. That somehow ultra-liberal to support LGBTQ rights and interracial marriage, again, something that we see and hear today. Jim Atkinson specifically says this was a hate crime. So there's no whataboutism, there's no deflection. Jim Atkinson specifically tells us what this was. He says that there's a left-wing conspiracy to destroy America. Again, this is common fodder. He says the shooting was a political protest. So again, it wasn't anything about resentment of poverty being a main thrust. This wasn't mental illness per se. This was someone who is committing a hate crime in the form of political protest by killing people. He expressed racism towards President Obama, which obviously still exists today. And he says real Americans should follow in his footsteps, patriots. And the term patriot, of course, has been completely hijacked by the modern right to mean something different from just having support for your country. And we'll look at that in a moment. Let's revisit this graphic from earlier. And of course, this graphic isn't specific in nature. Anyone could go onto any social media platform or simply go onto a web browser and look under images and find any number of examples of right-wing rhetoric that matches exactly what Jim Atkinson had stated in his manifesto as being the driving forces and factors as to why he committed the crime that he did. However, we have this graphic, so let's look at it. Jim Atkinson had stated that Democrats were aiding terrorists. Bill O'Reilly had said that Barack Obama, having somewhat of a heritage of people being Muslim in his past, might make him soft on terror or make him not a real American. And just recently here, we have Lauren Boebert suggesting that Ilhan Omar was a terrorist. And if you don't know who Ilhan Omar is, she's a representative from Minnesota who is Muslim. We have Marjorie Taylor Greene, and this was actually when she was running for office here, saying, "Save America, stop socialism with a gun." One of the things that Jim Acheson stated over and over again was that Democrats are socialists and communists, and that they need to be stopped. And he too used a gun to stop what he believed was a real threat. We see Tucker Carlson. So this is completely mainstream. It doesn't get any more mainstream than Fox News. This is evening news entertainment that reaches just untold numbers of people. The radical left, socialism goes mainstream. Just another image that I grabbed that showed up. This is a college Republican from Iowa State tweet. "Everyone, you must arm up. Expect these people to attempt to destroy your life. The elites want revenge on us." So in all of this, what we see is the exact same stuff that Jim Acheson had stated way back in 2008 as motivating him to go out and kill people. And we can see that obviously nothing has been done about this. This has not been addressed. And if anything, this type of rhetoric is more commonplace in today's world. In fact, this show has even covered extremely recent events that are in the same ecosystem in the same world as what Jim Acheson was discussing. The first being Lyndon James McLeod, who murdered people in Denver just a few weeks ago. And he did so out of right-wing grievance. Grievances about masculinity, LGBTQ rights. He had posted racist things in the past on social media, things based kind of in the manosphere, but all still firmly in play with Acheson. And shortly after, Tim Pool actually posted a anti-LGBTQ tweet, which was somewhat well-timed or shocking, depending on how you want to look at it. A few days after Lyndon James McLeod had gone on his shooting spree. And in the video on our YouTube channel where I dissect this Tim Pool tweet and just why it was so especially egregious, whether he had the foresight and intellect to make it so, or whether it was dumb luck. But within that breakdown and conversation, I discussed Jim Acheson and I discussed his manifesto specifically and how Tim Pool, even just last week, someone who gets pretty large viewership on alternative media, is expressing the exact same type of sentiments as those that radicalized and led Jim Acheson to murder back in 2008, but also the same type of things that would radicalize and provoke someone like Lyndon James McLeod to murder only a few weeks ago at the time of this, the video creation. In that manifesto, we also discovered why Acheson targeted this church. Now, Acheson's former wife, Lisa, who divorced him after he threatened her life, had attended this church. And so Acheson never stated that's why he attacked the church, but that's how he was introduced to the church for sure. This church was very open. It had safe spaces kind of early on in that movement for LGBTQ youth, for instance. There were discussion groups for multicultural movements and activities. And overall, this was a accepting church of people across the broad community of Tennessee. And it was the acceptance of multiracial marriage, of LGBTQ youth, of essentially having an open door policy for people to attend this church if they so chose. That was what really instigated and provoked Acheson. We heard that he would have rather have gone after political leaders and officials, but that he didn't have access to them. However, he did know about this church and he knew that it was a place that was accepting. And so he took his anger and hatred out on these people. July 27th, 2008 was the day that Akeson had decided he had had enough. He woke up that morning and prepared to execute his plan to kill as many liberals as he could for the good of the country, as told to him by right-wing media, before dying himself. At least he had believed he would die by police. Akeson hid a 12-gauge sawed-off Remington shotgun in his guitar case for transport. He was known in the community to be a talented guitar player, so this provided a method for surprise attack. He planned on opening the guitar case and then shooting as many people as he could in the church until police arrived, ultimately shooting him. It's not clear if Akeson was aware, but there is a children's play occurring at the Unitarian Universalist Church that morning. The church was filled with parents and other parishioners watching children perform the musical Annie. In fact, Jamie Parkey, an eyewitness, believed the first gunshot blast to have been part of the church play that his daughter was participating in. The first victim was Greg McKendry. McKendry moved in front of others to shield them from gunfire, being shot to death in the process. Greg McKendry was a very large gentleman. He did obviously stand up and put himself in between the shooter and the congregation, Sheriff Chadwick told reporters. McKendry died from his wounds at the scene. McKendry was 60 years old and was the foster parent to one of the children performing that morning. Taylor, the child or foster child of McKendry, said, "He was so much more than that. He was a hero in so many different ways. Greg was the first man I could ever call my father. He would fix people's problems without even being asked, and would have tried to help this man, Jim Akeson. Jim Akeson killed the man who would have tried hardest to help him." Linda Krager was the other murder victim. Krager, 61, was an author, scholar, and retired professor. Linda succumbed to her injuries later at the University of Tennessee Medical Center. Linda was in attendance that day to watch a fellow parishioner's six-year-old daughter perform in the play. There were other injuries that occurred as well, including, but not all, being Jack Barnhart, Linda Chavez, Tammy Summers, and Joe Barnhart. And while Akeson did injure others, he did not fulfill his goal of continuing to shoot until police arrived. Instead, the congregation acted quickly to subdue Akeson and they restrained him. He didn't get the violent fantasy of shooting down congregation members in a mass shooting, nor the suicide by cop that he had wanted. Olivia Spooner was another child performing that day. She was among the oldest and quickly transitioned from performer to protector after hearing the shots. She organized the younger children and moved them away from the violence. Spooner went on to write an essay on the shooting that won a nationwide writing contest sponsored by her denomination. Charlotte Clayman was a deacon at a neighboring church that ended up becoming a safe haven for the fleeing children. She said, "The child was so distraught and screaming, and he was dressed in a costume for the play. He said, 'They're shooting. They're shooting, they're going to kill my dad.'" Jamie Parkey, a church congregant, crawled under the pews with his daughter and mother when the second and third shots were fired. He saw several men rush Akeson. "I jumped up to join them," he told AP Television News. "When I got there, they were already wrestling with him. The gun was in the air, somebody grabbed the gun, and we just kind of dogpiled him to the floor. I knew suppression hold, and we held him until police arrived. It was all over in a matter of minutes. Police arrived on the scene and arrested Jim Akeson." Akeson was charged with two counts of first-degree murder, two counts of felony murder, and the deaths of the two congregants at the Knoxville Church. He was also charged with six counts of attempted first-degree murder. In court papers, prosecutors called Atkinson's crime an act of terrorism. Atkinson pled guilty to the charges to avoid the death penalty. During the trial, Atkinson exhibited repugnant behavior, as expressed by a survivor of the shooting who attended trial. When he first came out into the courtroom, he held a look of sheer evil. He really did. Evil as well as arrogance. The church music director, Vicki Masters, told CNN affiliate WVLT-TV. And he sat down and he looked around and he used his third finger, his middle finger, to scratch the back of his head with an air of arrogance and just pure evil. Those are the only words I could use to describe what I saw. Another congregant stated, "I'm sickened that he showed no signs of remorse." It was confirmed that Atkinson told police he targeted the church due to its liberal teachings. Atkinson also told police that he believed all liberals should be killed. When asked during a trial if he had anything to say, providing an opportunity for forgiveness, regret, remorse, Atkinson said, "No, ma'am, I have nothing to say." The church commemorated the 10-year anniversary just a few years ago, 2018. And there have been specials run, but mostly on local news stations about the event. The broader discussion of right-wing hate speech in media has mostly gone silent. One of the children at the performance that day, the one who lost her adopted father, has gone on to speak out against gun violence. Zoe Brookshire Risley has spoken publicly about mass shootings, especially Sandy Hook and Parkland, both of which have been targets for right-wing hate speech, conspiracy, and libel. Alex Jones, for example, recently lost a civil lawsuit making him liable for Sandy Hook defamation, but one only need to go to the Fox News site to view just the vitriol that has been tossed at students who have come out and spoken in favor of things like gun laws after these mass shootings, and via extension, people like Zoe, who lost her father to someone that was radicalized by that very same right-wing content. And of course, it is not as if media has gone silent on this issue of right-wing extremism and hate speech being mainstreamed. This is a graphic from the Southern Poverty Law Center, but it truly only captures a fragment of the violence being spurred by right-wing extremism that's occurred in the country. And honestly, this only reaches to 2018 as well. The ideas, the rhetoric, the hate speech that Jim Atkinson discussed in his manifesto and that motivated Jim Atkinson to murder has all been but mainstreamed in 2021, 2022. There are gangs, there are militias that operate freely. Their insignias can be seen on bumper stickers, on cars, just commuting to work on a daily basis. There's even a debate over what happened on January 6th, whether or not these people were actually violent. The fact that there's even a discussion, or the fact that there's two sides to that historic and documented event, tells you all that we need to know about how American society has progressed since 2006 and how what Jim Atkinson said in his manifesto has, again, been mainstreamed and is now accepted as just a part of America. Along with the commemorations that the church has and local news stories that run from time to time, there was a book that was published called Love is a Spirit. And I would encourage you all to go purchase it, whether or not you buy a hard copy or you buy the PDF. The PDF is only $10. But Love is a Spirit was a a book put together full of images as well as stories and sermons by survivors of the shooting events. And I think it's worth looking at just to create a juxtaposition between the new normal of right-wing hate speech being mainstreamed and common and seen every day and accepted without much pushback. The juxtaposition of what we see as normal in 2021 and just the positivity, the good people in this book that suffered a tragedy at the hands of somebody that was motivated by rhetoric for which we, again, openly accept as normal and okay. Just the juxtaposition between that darkness and the light that comes from the goodness in these people and the positivity that these people continue to exude within their community and the broader community of the country. And this is talking about 1 week after the shooting, and we can see some of the images that they're just very touching. But along with this is a sermon that I would like to view. These are excerpts from the rededication service that occurred after the shooting. Last Sunday, a man walked into the sanctuary with the intention of inflicting terror, and he inspired quick and decisive acts of courage. Reports tell us that he believed that liberals were soft on terror. He had a rude discovery. He came into this space with a desire to do an act of hatred, but has unleashed unspeakable amounts of love. A man tried to strike a blow for intolerance, and by doing so, he inspired a gathering. Monday night in the Second Presbyterian Church and many other holy places throughout the week, a gathering of Christians and Jews, Muslims and Buddhist believers and unbelievers, crowded the aisles, sitting on the stage, standing outside in the rain, holding, hugging, and helping each other to heal. A man tried to divide us into liberals and conservatives, gay and straight. Instead, his actions united us, making us much more willing to listen to each other, care for each other, respect each other, and support each other. And at the end of this book, after all the beautiful pictures, there's a section called Reflections, 10 Years Traversing the Arc of Healing. And so these people were survivors, and Linda Chavez, for example, someone who was actually injured in the shooting. And they wrote essays that discussed essentially how they had coped with this and what it is that they were doing now with their lives, including trauma therapy, volunteerism, and their views on the world. And so here we see those in power and on the media make statements about this issue, and she's talking about gun violence. And I find myself shaking my head, thinking, you really have no idea, do you? The Sandy Hook parents or the Parkland students speak, and I'm nodding. These days, fewer things are worth commenting on, and more things bring tears to my eyes. I put in my hearing aids every morning, and they remind me of how, in many ways, that day damaged me, and how the easiest damage to repair is taken care of by a couple of little computers resting in my ears. My professional life was spent largely in adolescent treatment centers, working in what most would consider difficult environments. I believe the most important thing I did in these tense and sometimes dangerous situations that frequently arose was to say as clearly as I could, in whatever way fit the moment best, this is where I stand. This is what is important. Tomorrow, I will be standing right here in the same place, and that you can count on me. Linda Chavez provides an especially emotional and grueling essay about her recovery, having been shot, as well as other life obstacles after the shooting. At the end, she says, "I recently gave a Be Smart gun safety presentation. Moms created this campaign to bring together all responsible adults to reduce suicides and the number of unintentional shootings that occur when children encounter an unsecured firearm. I was nervous while sharing my survivor story at the presentation, but if it can save one life, it was worth putting out there." This year will be the 10th anniversary, and I hope to spend a quiet evening with family, friends, and other survivors. I am concerned about the escalation of mass shootings, or any shooting, any aftermath of destruction that it leaves behind. Everytown.org reported that 96 Americans are killed in a day by gun violence. I joined Moms Demand Action this year, which is a nonpartisan grassroots organization that talks about educating the public regarding common sense gun laws and responsible gun ownership. These are not only the victims, these are the faces of victims if you're watching the video, but these aren't only the victims of right-wing domestic terrorists. You know, Jim Acheson did what he did and now he's in jail. But as you can hear, and this publication having been done a few years ago, with discussion of Sandy Hook school shooting, with discussion of Parkland, with discussion of gun violence in general. You know, these are the people that are attacked by people on Fox News, by people who have a lot of money and a big platform. And these are the people for whom others that listen to this that maybe don't have as much money or a platform. But these are the people that those folks are getting angry at. And I think it's important to make that connection. That, you know, when your uncle, your father, your friend begins to parrot or begins to change the way they speak and they begin sounding like these people in the media, whether it be Tucker Carlson or Michael Savage or Tim Pool or what have you, it doesn't really matter where. But when these people that you know, coworkers even, right, when they start saying things that are very clearly the words of others, whether it be about Democrats and liberals being communists or global conspiracies or racist rhetoric or just conspiracies in general about liberals and et cetera. When they do things like admonish kids, like the students at Parkland for trying to promote common sense gun laws, when they attack kids that have been attacked themselves, you know, these are also the people that they're attacking, these people. They're attacking people like Linda Chavez, who's trying to do good, who, if you read the book, has many obstacles to face, aside from recovering physically, mentally, and emotionally from being shot by someone who had been radicalized by right-wing media content. That trauma continues, and that these people who watch these things and repeat what they hear and see, and that these people who are propagating these things for profit or maybe actual personal belief, that they are still attacking these people as well. And that there doesn't need to always be two sides to a story. Sometimes there can be right and wrong. And that it's hard to say someone is wrong, but it's important to at times. And I think it's very clear after seeing this case study and looking at the broader social influences, that this is wrong. And so what's the legacy? You know, what are the lessons learned from this case study? Well, right-wing hate speech and media have not been held accountable, hardly at all. Perhaps Alex Jones, the most extreme, being one of the few. What was fringe and relegated to the internet in 2008 has gone mainstream. Elected Republican officials literally run on the violent hate speech that we saw echoed in Jim Acheson's manifesto. Podcasters and alternative media operate openly and freely while spreading even more extreme content than what we've discussed in this video and podcast. There's been no movement on gun laws, zero. Right-wing gangs and militias are mainstream. They operate openly and freely. And I would venture to guess that you've probably seen a bumper sticker on your way to work, whether it be a QAnon, whether it be an Oath Keepers, whether it be a 3%. You've seen a radical right-wing group propaganda sticker somewhere. I'm fairly certain of that. Overall, there's still this cultural belief that the left is more violent. And anytime any discussion is had about right-wing violence, it is always juxtaposed and compared to the left. And without going into that comparison here, what needs to happen and what needs to be understood is that regardless of whatever kind of debate or discussion is had, that does nothing to diminish or take away the violence that does come from the right. And right-wing violence needs to be addressed. Lastly, unfortunately, as stated earlier, Jim Acheson got almost everything that he wanted. Jim Acheson shot liberals. Jim Acheson had people follow in his footsteps, whether it was directly because of what he did or not. Still, adjacent to his manifesto were all the contributing factors of right-wing speech and media that went into formulating that, for whom these other people were definitely influenced by. He got that as well. There are politicians that run on the same rhetoric that Jim Acheson discussed while attempting to justify murdering. The only thing Jim Acheson didn't get was suicide by cop. So he is still alive in prison, and take that for what you will. However, in general, I think that this is an important case study because we have gone so far off the rails. We have gone so far to accepting absolutely unacceptable ideas, rhetoric, and policy. We have gone so far to the right in terms of extremism that our perspective has been lost. And this is an attempt to reframe things and ground things and maybe educate people on things that they didn't know. And honestly, this is something that everybody should know about, as well as Tim McVeigh, as well as Eric Rudolph. But these are things that many people don't know about because they're not prioritized. And it goes to an overall cultural bias in this country that, for whatever reason, seems to go light, go soft, skip over right-wing extremism. And that needs to stop.